I call this meeting of the House Education Policy Committee to order. A quorum is present. And our first order of business is approving the minutes. Representative Hill, have you had an opportunity to move the minutes, and would you like to make that motion?
That would be the motion.
Okay, great. Representative Hill moves to approve the minutes from Tuesday, March 18th. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. The motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. Okay, and members and testifiers, before we begin, we have a very packed agenda. And so to make sure that we have enough time to hear all the bills, the expectation is that testimony will take 2 minutes. Our committee legislative assistant has some note cards that'll show you 30 seconds and then due time. Please try to wrap up by then. And I will have to cut people off if it goes a little bit too far past that. But the first bill on our agenda is House File 1171, Ray Rauer, which is a math core bill. With that being said, I will move House File 1171 before us. And I believe there is an amendment from Representative Bennett that we're going to take care of. And also, just as a note for everyone, this bill has already been heard and had member discussion and testimony, so we will not be taking more testimony today. But Representative Bennett, would you like to move and explain your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I move the A2 amendment, and it simply adds a definition for evidence-based math, which we discussed in our last, when it was heard in committee. So that's what the amendment does.
Thank you. And Representative Ray Rauer, what are your feelings about this amendment?
Thank you so much, Chair Jordan. I appreciate the work that Chair Bennett did with us on this bill, and I very much appreciate her support in crafting this definition and this amendment, so I support it.
Okay, great, thanks. So we will move to adopt the A2 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. And the motion prevails. Representative Ray Rauer, any comments to your bill? And then we'll go to any member discussion.
Thank you, Chair Jordan. I would just like to thank you for bringing HF 1171 before the committee today, and I urge your support to move this on.
Great. Any discussion? Otherwise, we will move the bill to Education Finance.
Chair.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam
Chair Bennett.
Yes, I would just like to add that I support sending this bill out of committee. I think both Reading Corps and Math Corps are excellent programs, and focusing on literacy and math is very important. So thank you for bringing this bill forward, and I support moving that bill.
Great. Thank you, Chair Bennett. Members, with that, all those in favor of moving House File 1171, the Math Corps bill, to Education Finance as amended, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say nay. And the motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Ray Rauer.
Thank you.
The next bill on the agenda is House File 1901, Representative Moeller. And since Representative Moeller, as you're getting situated and you're not a member of the committee, I will move House File 1901 before us. And it is also my understanding that before we discuss your bill, you have an amendment or other amendments to adopt. So I will move the A2 amendment for you, Representative Moeller. Can you speak to this amendment for us?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairs and members. So the A2 amendment takes into feedback by both Chair Novotny and Representative Witte with some good feedback they gave for this bill. And so I would ask that you would support it, and I can explain it in more detail if anybody wants that.
Members, any discussion of the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. The A2 amendment is adopted. And Representative Moeller, would you like me to move the A3 amendment?
Sure, that would be great.
Okay, great. I will move the A3 amendment. Can you speak to that amendment as well?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So it has been a while since I've been on the Education Policy Committee, and as I was preparing for this committee, I remembered that when we say school districts, that can mean that some are included and some are excluded. And so we took a look, and the bill had certain reporting requirements for some school districts, but not all types of schools, versus the grants that would be eligible. So we wanted to match that up. I will also say that I have spoken with MIAC, and we may be proposing an amendment in the next stop to also add tribal schools. But right now, this amendment just matches up the language from the reporting with the grant eligibility.
Great. Thank you. Any discussion to the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. And the A3 amendment is adopted. Representative Moeller, two-year bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chairs and members. So the focus of this bill is to keep our students and staff safe from violence and also to prevent suicide. The bill on Section 4 appropriates grant funding for schools to implement anonymous threat reporting systems. Research shows us that those who commit mass violence often share their plans with someone, and it is especially true among school shooters and young shooters. A recent report found that in 4 out of 5 shootings, at least one other person knew of the shooter's plan but did not report it. And when a student leaks their plans to commit violence, whether that's harm against others or themselves, it's a critical time for mental health intervention to prevent violence from happening in the first place. Anonymous threat reporting systems provide students and staff with a resource to share tips of potential violence. And then the bill prioritizes these new grants because a key strategy to stopping any violence is being alert to warnings, to act on them immediately, and to have the right staff in place to respond to these tips. Schools who have these systems have found that it not only stops violence, but it helps students get the services they need when they are in crisis, so it does save lives with a suicide prevention. Second in this bill, in Minnesota, we do not know the full scope of how often active shooter threats or incidents in our schools are happening. We often hear anecdotes on the news, often when there's tragic headlines. So this bill, sections 2 and 3, require schools to report information regarding active shooter threats or incidents that occur to the Fusion Center in the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. This information will be included in the Fusion Center's annual report to the legislature, so provide good information on potential policy changes in the future. And it also will allow the BCA, if they're hearing about these things, to be able to follow up with local law enforcement if they haven't been involved already. And then there's another component of the bill in Section 1 that strengthens the use of threat reporting systems in schools, whether that's a local option, and there are some schools that have their own programs that are running very well, or there's a statewide option. Actually, the BCA already has an app, but it is not really known about. And so we want to make sure that students and staff are just informed about this. They already get training on active shooter threats, and so they would just be told then that they also have this BCA app available to report, or whatever system the school district may have in place to use that. Finally, the language in this bill has been reworked to remove any cost. Initially, there was a cost to MDE, and we were able to rework that to remove that note. So the only cost would be with the grants, and that will come out of the public safety's budget, and the bill will be heading there next, where we can discuss that as well. And just to be clear, schools in the reporting are only required to report these active shooter threats or incidents as narrowly defined in this bill. So this isn't something we expect to be very regular and rigorous reporting, and the BCA will have the form, a short form they can fill out and send to the BCA. I was supposed to have a testifier here, but alas, she works in a school and she was called to a mandatory meeting and she was unable to join me, and I do have her testimony to read if that's acceptable, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Moeller, if you can be brief and then we'll go to member discussion.
Sure. Okay. So her name is Holly Ryan, and she's a nationally certified school psychologist who has worked in Lakeville area schools for 24 years. She serves as the district's threat assessment specialist, overseeing implementation, training, coordination of district threat assessments, anonymous reporting, and other safety initiatives. She's involved in many other threat assessment teams. She is supportive of the legislation. And she describes how these anonymous threat reporting systems remove barriers that prevent students and staff from speaking up, fear of retaliation, being labeled as a snitch, and not knowing where to turn if a if a concern is credible often stops individuals from reporting concerning behavior. And these platforms provide a safe, confidential, and accessible way to report threats and other concerning behaviors, allowing trained professionals to assess risks and intervene before tragedy occurs. And then she gives a lot of great information and data, but the first time I talked to her, I remember her talking about how oftentimes it could be a student anonymously reporting themselves even, or other students who really are at risk of suicide, and that it is a very good tool to help in helping those students who are in crisis. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on House File 1901? Great, we will move to member discussion. Representative Green.
Thank you, Chair Jordan, and thank you, Representative Mueller, for bringing this bill forward. I'm thrilled to see this bill. This is such a topic that is talked about, especially among students. I think having a anonymous reporting structure is gonna save lives. Absolutely. So I really appreciate that. My question is, in doing this work and providing this this pathway to, for reporting, was there any discussion about or any thoughts about adding in safe storage information and education for students? Was that ever be considered within this bill, or did you consider it?
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that question. You know, I'm a big proponent of safe storage, and we've had other bills that have been moving in that regard. I was working on a very bipartisan basis with this bill, and so if that's something, even the notification of that maybe is part of the training, if I could get bipartisan support just for that, I think that would be fantastic. So,
Representative Green, any follow-up?
No, thank you. I would love to help work with you on that.
Thank you.
Any other member discussion? Chair Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Mueller. This is an important bill and a good bill. There are some small components here I think can be adjusted slightly, but I see the value of what this bill is trying to accomplish and would support moving it on to public safety. And I'm sure you'll continue to work with Chair Novotny and Representative Whitney on that end, and looking forward to seeing it most likely come back here and moved on as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Bennett. Chair Mueller, any closing comments?
Thank you. I appreciate the comments, the suggestion, and always glad to continue working on it. If you have anything specific you'd like to see different about this bill, of course, please reach out. And I forgot to mention before that a number of states have systems like these. They're both blue and red states. And I really do think, you know, the goal is to prevent violence of any kind, and the fact that we can help students who are struggling in crisis, I think is a good one. And so thanks for your support.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. And with that, I move to re-refer House File 1901 as amended to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. And the motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Mueller. Next on the list is Representative West, House File 2023, Opiate and Overdose Prevention, Education, and Health Standards. Welcome to the committee, Representative West. Representative Bennett, would you like to move House File 2023 before us?
Madam Chair, I move House File 2023 before us for what potential
later? To be held over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative West. Would you like to tell us more about House File 2023?
I would love to, Madam Chair. Thank you for hearing this bill, and thank you to the committee for having me and being very kind and generous with your comments. I'll just thank you in advance. So one thing I like about this bill, it is merely a sentence if you don't count the effective date. It adds overdose recognition, prevention, and response education to the health standards that were passed last year. I don't necessarily, you know, I'm not super excited about state standards when it comes to health. I think local districts do a very good job on it. But if we are going to have them, we know our country and state and basically all our communities are dealing with opioid epidemic. It is taking, like, going to be millions and millions of lives across the nation. And with the rise of fentanyl coming into our country and with the lethality that that has, education is more important than ever, to where you have people have overdoses from merely coming into contact with this substance is something that people should be very aware of. And with the increased prevalence throughout our communities in it, with this drug coming into our country, I think it's important to have students educated on recognizing it and dealing with it should the worst happen. This bill was brought to me by some students, and they were very passionate about it and put a lot of effort in, and I believe they are here to rally support for the bill.
Thank you, Representative West. The first testifier on the list is Kalik Rogers from Catalyst for Systems Change, and then next will be Maitreya Reeder. But first on the list is Kalik Rogers. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony and try to keep it to about 2 minutes if you can.
Absolutely. Proceed. Hello, everyone. Hello, Chair and committee members. My name is Kalik Rogers. I actually serve as the Executive Director of Catalyst for Systems Change. My work is rooted in lived experience, having faced housing instability as a youth, and knowing people in my family and in my broader community who have abused drugs as well. Through my journey, I saw firsthand that the systemic issues within housing, workforce, and education are deeply interconnected. Addressing these require a cross-sector, intergenerational approach that ensures young people are not just a part of the conversation, but helping lead the solutions. That's why I created the Changemakers Program. It's a statewide initiative that equips youth with the skills and platform to shape public policy based off their lived experiences. And House File 2023 is a direct result of that work. At our Changemakers event in 2024, youth across the state identified overdose prevention education as their number one legislative priority. They researched the gaps in current health education and saw the consequences in their own community. They're asking for a simple but powerful clarification of existing state law, ensuring that substance abuse education also includes overdose recognition, prevention, and response education. So we are delighted that this effort has gained bipartisan support and that it is more than just a slight clarification. It is a life-saving solution designed by those most affected. The youth who have worked on this bill will share their research and personal stories, and we hope their research and leadership garners your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Next on the list is Maitreya Reeder. Please correct my pronunciation of your name by restating it, and then proceed with your testimony. And then next on the list will be Sophia Templos. Go ahead.
Yes, of course. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Maitreya Reeder. I would like to thank everyone here for my opportunity to speak and also for allowing the utilization of this building for the November 23rd Catalyst for Systems Change Changemakers event for youth, sparking the creation of this bill today from their ideas. As I've stated, my name is Maitreya Reeder. I'm a resident of Minneapolis and of the Chair's District, as well as a junior at St. Anthony Village High School. I also currently serve as the 45th Minnesota Youth Secretary of State and a 2025 National Youth Advocate. I want to express my overwhelming support for the inclusion of overdose prevention and response in the Minnesota Health Education Standards for many reasons. The United States has implemented policies to stop drug trade and use for more than a century. The war on drugs started over 53 years ago, and there have been several following waves of attempts to curb fatalities. However, overdose-related deaths are only just starting to decline since their peak in 2022 at over 100,000 fatal overdoses that year alone. While these efforts to stop drug use must continue, there needs to be further measures in place to protect our population. Addiction and overdose have never been isolated problems. They affect every single American, whether indirectly or directly, every day. Every week, I care for children who mostly come from underserved backgrounds. And a few months ago, the mother of a pair of siblings I watch over died from a fatal overdose. Her youngest child is 2. She doesn't understand where her mother has gone. It is also important to recognize the fact that fentanyl contamination has resulted in a recent rise in deaths of teens and young adults. According to a UCLA health report, an average of 22 adolescents aged 14 through 18 died every week from drug overdoses in 2022, and approximately 90% of these deaths involved opioids. These statistics are my friends. Thank you, and I yield my time to the chair.
Thank you. Next on the list is Sophia Templos, and after that will be Dexter Posh. Welcome to the committee. Please restate your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sophia Templos, and I am a senior at the School of Environmental Studies in Apple Valley. I also work part-time as a nursing assistant with Ecumen in Apple Valley as well. It is truly an unbelievable honor for me to stand or sit before you this afternoon. In 2023, I experienced firsthand what it was like to watch a family's life fall apart because their loved one was taken away from fentanyl poisoning. The worst part of this reality was knowing that the outcome was completely preventable. Referencing the drug overdose dashboard for the Minnesota Department of Health, over 1,000 Minnesotans died of opioid-related overdoses in 2023. Fentanyl itself is not typically sought out by its users. It can be hidden in many other drugs, and just 2 milligrams can be fatal. As easy as it is to be exposed to this, it has been proven that it's even easier to die from it. Fentanyl does not discriminate, and it can take from anybody. One of Minnesota's most recent drug epidemic memorials, called Gone in a Snap, which took place in August of last year, was dedicated to raising awareness on how easily fentanyl can be sold through social media platforms. Out of the 30-plus lives that were remembered that day, you would be surprised to learn how many of these individuals were surrounded by people who did not know how to use naloxone to save their lives. Naloxone is the life-saving tool that could have saved so many lives, lives that were full of potential and lives that were prematurely taken away. By educating our youth, we can ensure that in the event of an emergency, people will know what to do when an overdose occurs. We may be able to not stop fentanyl use entirely, but we as a community can start today by taking the next step to ensure that not another mother, father, sister, brother, or friend will have to live without a loved one who should still be with us today. Members of the committee, I call upon you to think about the people that you care about and serve, and I urge you to think about how much longer this will go on for and how many more of us will be lost if something does not change. I plead to you to take a stand today to ensure that more of us will see tomorrow, as we cannot afford to wait any longer. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on my list is Dexter Posh, and then after that will be Tom Kotke. Welcome to the committee. Please restate your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman and committee members. My name is Dexter Posh, a junior at Harding Senior High School. I believe this should become a reality because I live in a community that's riddled with overdose deaths. My county that I live in has lost 121 people to overdose in 2024 alone. And I'm part of a proud Native American community where in Minnesota in 2021, we lost 157 people. The year after, 167. And the year after that, 155 Natives in Minnesota passed due to overdose. And already in January this year, 84 Minnesotans have passed due to overdose. And if teaching awareness of it can even reduce a fraction of the roughly 1,000 overdose deaths in Minnesota a year, it would mean so much more to the friends and family that still have that person in their life. And this is coming from knowledge of many stories I've heard from family and friends that have lost friends and family. Thank you for your time, Madam Chairman.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on my list is Dr. Tom Kotke. Welcome to the committee. Please restate your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Thomas Kotke. I live in St. Paul District, 64A, and I've practiced cardiology for 40 years at the University of Minnesota Mayo Clinic, Rochester, and Health Partners until I retired in December 2024. During that time, I also advocated for measures to improve community health because it is in this space that the greatest gains in health and well-being occur, and a prosperous Minnesota requires a healthy Minnesota. I support the change in the language because of the mortality statistics. In the 10 to 14 age group in Minnesota, the total death rate is 16 per 100,000, and the rate of accidental poisoning is 1 per 100,000. Accidental poisoning is overdose. By the ages of 20 to 34, total death rate has increased eightfold to 129 per 100,000, and 32% of all deaths are from accidental poisoning. The rate of accidental poisoning has increased 40-fold. It shouldn't be this way. These people are in the prime of life. They should be in the labor force, not in the ground. When an individual suffers an overdose, I believe it is rarely in the presence of a physician, a firefighter, a police officer, or another individual trained in overdose prevention. It is the presence of peers and friends who could help if they had the knowledge and the skills and the tools. Today, the students are telling you that they want to help, and if you can help them help by adding to the text that will cause them to be trained in overdose recognition, prevention, and response. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your time. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on this bill? Okay, with that, we will go to member discussion. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This issue is one I think everybody in this room has a connection to in some way, shape, or form. And I have a few close ones that I, you know, it's something that has motivated me to look and study this issue for years already now since I've been up here and trying to figure out how do we prevent this? How do we bend that curve? I've done conferences across the country on this, looking at other states. How are they bending the curve, which we are only just now doing in Minnesota after 100,000 deaths each year the last however many they are, and slightly less than that before that, because the problem has just gotten worse and worse. So I applaud the students who are up here today, and I just want to note that the change makers work and having this be the number one thing that students are bringing to us. I mean, we heard the statistics from the students that should be impacting all of us. I mean, I'm hoping this is a universal yes vote on this because it's that important. We have fought the epidemic and tried to do things like adjusting opioid prescribing through our health system, which helped, but this thing just morphed into other means of distribution and other products and has gotten worse. And so education, I've thought for a while now, is probably our best bet to really further bend the curve. After some initial harm reduction we've been able to do has bent the curve, we need so much more. And so I'm really thrilled that this can come about to be, you know, put together with what the students are saying. It's their number one choice. Think about that. Getting some language in and some education into a health curriculum to teach kids about the issue, but also about how to react to it, how to recognize it, how to prevent it, and how to respond to it. Because, you know, the statistic of having fewer deaths is true. While that's true, overdoses have still gone up, and people have been saved by naloxone. So this is really still part of the harm reduction part of this. Longer term, it's got to be through education, a health curriculum directed at our kids and the rest of society, but especially our kids right now. And so I'm really happy about, I'm excited about health curriculum standards for the state for a lot of reasons. I mean, it's about, as Representative West said, it's about knowledge. It's about safety for our kids. But it's also so much more than that, and why we should have health standards, mental health, physical, emotional, nutritional. But it comes back to that public health issue. So I would just want to express thanks to Ms. Reeder for the statistics she called out, and Mr. Posh, the statistics as well, and especially to Sophia Templos, who lives in my district, contacted me. We had a conversation. We talked about this issue. We talked about the opioid crisis. And the depth of knowledge of these kids is amazing. And I just, hats off to you for doing this and this advocacy. And I really think that, you know, this is number one. I want to know what the other top 10 are for you you know, because I think hearing from our kids and applying that into health is extremely important. I apologize to the chair. I said I would be brief. I'm not very brief. But thank you for bringing this bill forward. Thank you, members, for supporting it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. Representative West? Great. We'll move on to Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill. I actually just had a conversation with my assistant principal in the middle school of Moorhead just yesterday about vaping and about the issues that they're seeing on the administrative level. And one of the things that she sent to me, because I love the statistics, is that 1% of our student body has reached a level of vape violation that they're truly at a loss on what to do. The education, confiscation, and consequences just don't seem to be helping. So it is really a major issue. These are like students that are young, they're on the cusp of the disease of addiction. And we need to really support that. I think the more troubling statistic that we have in our district is 15 to 20% of students are already at that potential space of trying vaping. We're talking about fifth and sixth graders. So the question I have for you, I'm with the bill. I appreciate it. In line 1.13, it says that it starts at sixth grade. I just get nervous about some of the schools that are seeing these actions happening any younger, that if a school district, you know, wants to add these conversations and these prevention strategies into a younger age, how would they be able to still do that?
Representative West.
Well, lines 1.13 is language that was passed last year, so that is not, you know, new language within this bill. This bill adds in just below that related to overdose recognition, prevention, and response education. Why it starts at sixth grade? Well, that's not a policy choice of this bill, but I guess I will offer a comment on it. Below that is getting pretty heavy subject matter for, you know, a fifth grader and below, and especially when you're considering parents, what parents want to talk about it with their children or not. So sixth grade, I think, I mean, Lord willing, there's not a lot of drug users, and below that, I'm sure there are, and everything is more horrifying than we imagine. But I think sixth grade is generally thought to be appropriate, at least when the health standards were passed prior to this bill.
Representative Keeler. Okay. Any other member discussion? Chair Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative West, for your work on this issue. There is no denying that adolescent substance abuse and overdoses is a serious problem, and I echo Representative Bierman. I would be willing to say that everybody in this room, including our members here, have been touched in some way with substance abuse with family members or friends or whomever. So it is serious. I am concerned about amending this language, and I've talked to you about it, Representative West, into the new health standards mandate. While we still have a requirement under Section 120B.215 for local comprehensive education programs on cannabis use and substance use for students, that involves middle school and high school, and this language doesn't touch that. I think that's an area that could easily be tweaked. I would urge the author and advocates to consider how best to use that underlying statutory provision that's already in there in law, rather than relying on state standards writing committee. You can put it exactly the way you want it in the current statute. So that's my comments. I thank you for bringing this issue forward because it is an important one.
Thank you, Chair Bennett. Thank you, Representative West. It is great to have some of my constituents also testifying in favor of this bill. And as good as I think the bill is before us, it really is, you know, hearing from students. So thank you to all the students who testified today and made this bill happen. It's because of you that we're having this hearing today. So thank you. Representative West, any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I wish I was that put together when I was a student, I will say that. Well, I probably had a little smoother college experience and beyond. But this is a real problem, the opioid epidemic going around in our country. And that is where my support for this bill lies, is just thinking about this, making sure people are aware of it. It's been a huge problem. And one thing one of the students said that I thought was incredibly poignant is calling it fentanyl poisoning not a fentanyl overdose. Because if you can die by merely touching something, that is poisoning more than anything. Thank God it's mostly in a hospital setting where fentanyl, my wife's a pharmacist, so I'm very, very informed as a layperson can be of the uses, the positive uses of fentanyl, but the fact that we've had so much coming into our country and having it be in many other substances people don't anticipate means people need to be aware. So I really appreciate the committee's support on this measure. I think Madam Chair better make sure this gets in, or else she'll have a primary challenger in like 5 years. I don't know. But I appreciate you taking the time to hear this bill.
Thank you, Representative West. And with that, Representative Bennett renews her motion to weigh over House File 2023 for possible inclusion or further consideration. Thank you. Now I'm going to hand over the gavel to Vice Chair Hill while we work through the last two bills.
All right, our next bill is House File 2483, and while Chair Jordan is still settling in, this is a vehicle bill in a procedural vote, so I'll move the House File 2483 before us and to be recommended to be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. Motion prevails. All right, let's see. Is she going to speak to it? Great. Wonderful. With that, I'll hand it over to Chair Jordan to talk to House File 2483. Excuse me, 1306.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I move, thank you for your members, your help with the vehicle bill. I move House File 1306 to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Members, this is the Minnesota Department of Education's policy bill for 2025. I have with me Commissioner Jett and Megan Ariola from MDE to explain the bill and answer questions about what's going on. So with that, I would just hand it over to MDE to present the bill and talk more about what they have in mind.
Excuse me, Chair Jordan, before we get started with the bill description, did you want to move the A1 amendment?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for reminding me about the A1 amendment. I would move the A1 amendment, and I would defer to Ms. Ariola for explaining it.
Ms. Ariola.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Megan Ariola. I'm the Legislative Policy Manager for the Minnesota Department of Education. I will make references as we go line by line through the bill to areas that have been amended, but largely this is feedback reflective of nonpartisan feedback when they were kind enough to identify some areas that they felt could be clearer or a little bit elaborated on and relocated. So I will do my best to point to the areas that were amended in here, but largely this is a technical amendment.
Wonderful. Any discussion on the amendment?
Why can't I open this thing?
Seeing none, we'll take a vote to adopt the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Good. We've adopted the amendment. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would defer to the department.
Commissioner Jett.
Good afternoon,
Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Willie Jett, and I have the honor of serving as the Commissioner of Education for the great state of Minnesota. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today regarding the Governor's Education Policy Bill, HF 1306, and I will provide a brief overview before my colleague, Megan Ariola, walks you through a detailed section-by-section presentation. The bill is designed to accomplish a few objectives. First, ensuring that clarity and consistency in our education statutes. Second, providing stability for schools and students, and reflecting the values we uphold as Minnesota's education agency. The education laws enacted in 2023 and 2024 biennium brought significant investments to our state and introduced important policy updates to modernize our education system. These laws were shaped by the voices of students and young Minnesotans, reinforcing our shared commitment to high-quality education for all, regardless of background, economic status, or zip code. Many provisions in this bill refine existing laws based on feedback from educators and communities. For example, it clarifies that students in charter and tribal contract schools have access to the rigorous coursework available across the state. It extends the approval period for adult basic education programs to 6 years, ensuring they receive the same funding and support opportunities as in other states. It also removes ambiguities in the law that could hinder the effective implementation of the READ Act. At the Minnesota Department of Education, we believe in continuous improvement. When we hear about challenges, we respond. And this approach guides our work and reflects the expectations we set for all of our education partners. Minnesota charter schools are public schools, and we want all public schools to thrive. However, recent events in the charter school sector have raised concerns about students' consistent access to a strong and reliable education. This bill strengthens accountability, increases transparency, and encourages early interventions when warning signs arise. These provisions set clear expectations for our charter school partners. Additionally, as part of the governor's broader effort to prevent fraud and ensure responsible stewardship of public funds, this bill includes updates to the statute governing the Minnesota Department of Education's Office of Inspector General. We welcome continued discussions on the OIG's role, and we appreciate the legislature's collaboration in providing the necessary tools to strengthen oversight and protect program integrity. And so I look forward, we look forward, to working together to fulfill the responsibilities entrusted to us by our constituents. And with that, I will now turn the microphone over to Ms. Ariola for a detailed walkthrough of the bill.
Thank you, Commissioner Jett. Whenever you're ready, Ms. Ariola.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Like I said, for the record, my name is Megan Ariola. I'm the Legislative Policy Manager for the Minnesota Department of Education. I will direct members to the presentation in their packets and the general public to the presentation posted online or in the hallway. As with everything we do, the commissioner mentioned that MDE's work is guided by our 10 Minnesota commitments to equity. Starting off strong, so Article 1, Section 1, beginning on line 1.22, this clarifies that academic standards, in the academic standards statute, that academic standards are not grade level specific. Academic standards are established for K-12 education system as a whole in Minnesota, but benchmarks determine the grade level specificity. Article 1, Section 2, beginning on line 2.15, this change makes it clear that health education teachers already providing CTE, career and technical education courses with a relevant focus in health are exempt from additional teaching rules and requirements if they meet the statute requirement for CTE teachers. This section will also provide school districts the opportunity to grant credit equivalency to CTE health science courses that meet or surpass the relevant state and local standards for health education or related science credits. Similar credit options are available in other areas of CTE education. Sections 3, 4, 5, and 7 all deal with the same issue. So Section 3 begins line 3.20, Section 4 begins line 4.15, Section 5 begins 4.29, and 7 begins 6.4. All of these sections amend the PSEO statute to make it clear that PSEO programs are able to be accessed by Minnesota students in charter schools and tribal contract schools as well. This has been MDE's guidance for a while, and this is aligning statute with our interpretation. Article 1, Section 6, beginning on line 5.9, is also an amendment to the PSEO Act, but amends a different section. The PSEO Act currently does prohibit post-secondary institutions from advertising or otherwise recruiting secondary students for PSEO on financial basis. And there were two carve-outs in law for specific years, 2014 to 2015, and 2019 to 2020, that post-secondary institutions were allowed to advertise with a focus on financial benefits. But since those years are now long past, we are asking to remove the obsolete language from statute. Article 1, Section 8, beginning line 7.2, is an amendment to the Online Instruction Act. When we did a full repeal and replace of the formerly known Online Learning Act with the current and more modern Online Instruction Act, there were a few inadvertent omissions regarding the definition of supplemental online course providers. It does not include charter schools, but that was intended, and it does include non-public schools, which MDE does not currently have the authority to monitor, so amending the statute to make clear that the supplemental online course provider definition and standards from the Online Learning Act are consistent through the Online Instruction Act, and aligns statute with best practice and guidance. Article 1, Section 9, beginning on line 8.4, has to do with adult basic education programs. ABE programs may be approved for up to 6 years under this change. Current statute limits ABE program approval for only up to 5 years. However, we have heard from directly from ABE programs that there are national or other private grant opportunities available that do require a 6-year program term. So in order to make sure that they have access to grant opportunities that they may wish to take advantage of that other states have, this is just aligning us with best practice so that they don't lose that ability to apply for those funds. Article 1, Section 10 on line 10.2 is a reviser instruction that also deals with the PSEO for students in charter schools and tribal contract schools. So this is a reviser instruction that if there's any other areas in the PSEO Act where we missed defining district to say district, charter school, or tribal school, this is a reviser instruction to catch anything that we might not have been able to address in this bill. Article 2, Education Excellence. Article 2, Section 1 begins on line 10.9. When there are several references to the term school readiness in the definition of the Comprehensive Achievement and Civic Readiness, formerly known as the World's Best Workforce Statute, we have heard feedback from the field that particularly for families who may not be as familiar with Western education and our school systems, the term school readiness can be off-putting and make families nervous about engaging with the ECFE and other pre-K-12 education opportunities that may be available to them and their children. So there was a large group of concerned advocates and representatives of various community groups that met with MDE and came up with this this replacement for the term school readiness to be replaced with striving to support successful learners through inclusive, quality, developmentally appropriate early learning experiences. Article 2, Section 2, beginning on line 11.8, this clarifies that standards of measuring growth for the purposes of target language outcomes for dual language immersion programs have to be consistent for all students in the program, regardless of that individual student's English learner status. Article 2, Section 3, beginning on line 14.12, is clarifying and updating definitions in the school student bullying statute. Elaborating on the definition of what remedial responses may include removes existing confusion in the field about what does and does not qualify as an adequate remedial response under the statute. And then adding a definition of familial status to certain sections of the school student bullying statute only. I want to make that clear. And Article 2, Section 4 makes the same replacement of the term parent for the purposes of the school bullying statute with individuals with familial status. We have heard that when it comes to parental or adult involvement in school bullying issues, there was confusion from the districts whether other adults in the student's life besides the parent could assist with any sort of remedial responses or engage with the school on behalf of the child for bullying issues only. So elaborating on the term instead of just limiting it to parents, replacing that with individuals with familial status accounts for some of the non-traditional family structures. Article 2, Section 5, beginning on line 17.13, clarifies our state authority regarding departmental procedure when a report of a student bullying issue is brought to our attention. The current statute reads that MDE may investigate these, but with the creation of the OIG at MDE, we want to be very careful about the words we use. So replacing the word investigate with assessment or assessing and evaluating is more reflective of the work that this team is actually able to do, because as we know, the term investigation has a different meaning for the sake of the Office of Inspector General. Article 2, Section 6, beginning on line 18.15, adds a statutory definition of comprehensive school mental health systems. We've heard that districts want to address and want to be helpful for students' mental health while in schools, but many of them just don't know if what they're doing is enough, what other opportunities they need to have. So being able to have something in statute that folks can point to and say, this is what an ideal comprehensive school mental health service looks like if you choose to implement that in your school. Article 2, Section 7, beginning on line 19.2, corrects the definition of suspension under the Pupil Fair Dismissal Act, updating the definition section of statute to reflect changes made to suspension in other areas of statute, and clarifying here that suspension does not apply to dismissals for less than one school day, and this mirrors language throughout the rest of statute as well. Article 2, Section 8, beginning on line 19.18, is a one-year extension and a name clarification to the kindergarten fall assessment. When this assessment passed in last biennium, there were just a few references of it was being called the kindergarten entry assessment. We heard both from the field and from the vendors that it is more accurate to call it a fall assessment, because this isn't intended to be given multiple times during the school year for children who may enter mid-year. This is meant to be given as for the whole class in the fall. And also the request to push this back, the implementation back 1 year, was another request from the field that we reflect in this section as well. In the A1 amendment, we relocated a section of law from Article 5 into Article 2, just where it was more appropriately located for subject matter. So Article 2, and with the amendment, I believe it'll be Section 8 at that point, clarifies that student expulsion hearing records must be provided as a written transcript to the parent or guardian of the student for a complete record for the sake of appeals. I will refer back to this as we get into Section 5 as well. Article 3, Charter Schools. Article 3, Section 1 begins on line 20.17. This defines competitive procurement process in charter statute and adds to the definition of market need and demand study, making it clear that this study must occur and be updated for all proposed expansions of grades, sites, and programs for charter schools. Article 3, Section 2, beginning line 21.24, clarifies that all of Chapter 120B applies to charter schools, and requires that charters comply with the screen time limits for pre-kindergarten and kindergarten students that passed last year. Again, MDE's guidance has been that they have to follow all of the requirements under Chapter 120B, but existing law cites to a much more specific area of statute. So removing that specific reference makes it clear that all of Chapter 120 does apply to charter schools. Article 3, Section 3, beginning on line 22.20, amends the date of when charter schools have to notify MDE when they plan to merge. Currently, they have to notify MDE about their plans to merge on July 1st, which, as folks may know, is the start of the fiscal year. So any intervention or assistance that MDE may be able to provide is kind of the work is already beginning on the first day of the fiscal year. So it does end up with just a little bit of a conflict there. If we have feedback to provide, we don't want to be interrupting work that's been done, but we also know that there's some areas where we can provide support and resources. So just pushing that required notification date back a month to June 1st will give our staff enough time to review the merger plan and offer any technical feedback or advice that we feel may be helpful for the schools. Article 3, Section 4, beginning on line 23.1, is adding a new subparagraph to make it clear that charter schools that change location must also update their market need and demand study for the new location, and that they also must submit this demand study to their authorizer for approval. Article 3, Section 5 begins on line 23.10. This would require that charter school board meetings must be audio and video recorded and published on the school's website within 30 days of the hearing. This section was also amended by the A1 amendment to add language clarifying that the recordings must be published within 30 days following the whichever comes earlier, the date of board approval or the next regularly scheduled board meeting, and that they have to post this for at least 365 days from the date of publication. This mirrors language about what we expect for our school boards in terms of longevity for how long they have to keep the posting up. Article 3, Section 6, beginning on line 23.24, requires that charter schools submit their audit reports to MDE with all supplemental information on an annual basis. Currently, charter schools do submit annual audit reports to their authorizers with a litany of information, and what is reported to MDE is just a little, is just less than what we know they have on hand for information. So in the interest of being able to be on the lookout for warning signs, kind of watch a historic progression of the relationship of the auditing of those numbers over time will give us an opportunity to, again, be able to provide resources and support for charter schools that we feel may be struggling or if we are seeing any concerns in their reports over time. This is already information that charter schools have to submit to their authorizers, so it would just be adding MDE as a recipient as well. Article 3, Section 7, beginning on line 24.20, corrects an errant reference, and this is a change that you really gotta look for because it strikes just one word on line 25.14. This is a statute talking about the responsibilities for the charter management organization or the education management organization, and there's a reference in here to charter school boards. Often, charter schools have their own boards, and these CMOs and EMOs, as they're known, have their own boards of directors, and this statute was meant to refer to the latter. So striking that from this statute just, again, provides some statutory integrity. Article 3, Section 8, beginning on line 26.10, requires the charter school authorizer performance evaluation report to be published on the charter school website. We added a similar amendment to Section 5 on this section as well, regarding the amount of time that the posting has to be done, and then there was a reference that they had that the posting has to be in languages that families understand, and we heard feedback that charter schools already have language access plans that account for the languages that their families speak, so adding a reference back to the charter school's language access plan in statute just makes it clear that if you already have this in place, this can mirror that work. Article 3, Section 9, beginning on line 26.16, updates statutes to reflect procurement policy amendments from last biennium. There was a significant amount of work done around the statute governing charter board procurement policies, and this is just adding some statutory cleanup to make sure that the full impact of that is in the appropriate places. This section also clarifies the different requirements between sealing bids and soliciting quotes for the sake of charter procurement. Article 3, Section 10, beginning on line 27.3, adds some more detail regarding purchases made in conformance or out of conformance with state law. Article 3, Section 11, beginning on line 28.8, is a clarification to the procurement statute to explicitly state that if a purchase with state dollars does not align with a charter procurement policy, that there is a potential reduction in state aid that could occur. Article 3, Section 12, beginning on line 28.13, is a reviser instruction. Last year, there was a movement of the Charter Management Organization and the Education Management Organizations within to their own area of statute, and this is a reviser instruction to just make some cleanup amendments because of that movement. Article 4 deals with the READ Act. Article 4, Section 1, beginning on line 28.22, just clarifies that certified trained facilitators may be employed by a district or a Minnesota service cooperative. This section was also amended by the author's amendment to clarify that reference to a service cooperative is a Minnesota service cooperative. And then this section was also amended by the A1 to strike the final sentence of the existing law, which is redundant with some of the clarifications that we have made in other areas of the READ Act. Article 4, Section 2 is a clarification to the definition of oral language to include expressive and receptive language as part of that. This aligns with best practices in the field. Article 4, Section 3, beginning line 29.10, amends the grade level reading goals under the READ Act to be aligned to appropriate benchmarks and the MTSS framework established in other areas of the READ Act. This section was also amended by the author's amendment to replace the term relevant with responsive when we refer to culturally responsive to align with references throughout the rest of the READ Act. Article 4, Section 4, beginning line 29.29, this section adds clarifying languages around screening for certain students in grades 1 and 2 and regarding what assessments may be collected via the same screeners. This section was also amended by the author's amendment to replace the existing reference to the grade 1 screener with a reference to a grade 2 screener in the appropriate location, and this conforms with other expectations and screening requirements around dyslexia for this particular age group. Article 4, Section 5 is another single word amendment to law. So on line 31.17, we strike timely from statute regarding notification because there is more language above that was added that adds more definition to what we mean when we talk about parental notification in terms of timelines. So having timely in there was, we heard from the field, confusing as to what standard of time they had to be beholden to. Article 4, Section 6, beginning on line 31.28, this section removes the requirement around personal reading plans specific to literacy because we know that the MTSS frameworks that have been added throughout other areas of the READ Act require similar things to be part of a student's literacy plan that the personal learning plan would require just some redundant paperwork and some administrative time from our school districts, so trying to ease that burden there. Article 4, Section 7, on line 33.32, there is a striking of a reference to oral when we are talking about academic language development for the sake of professional development. This section is not meant to be limited to oral language development only, so that single striking word just helps make that clear. Article 4, Section 8, beginning on line 34.11, amends the local literacy plan statute to emphasize the importance of evidence-based curricula, amends posting requirements for LEAs, and then clarifies some of the information that is required to be reported. Article 4, Section 9, beginning on line 36.12, clarifies that approved screeners may be administered by district staff or external partners offering literacy support, and that these administrating adults are, that they do have to use approved screeners. Article 4, Section 10, beginning on line 36.23, is a clarification around the READ Act training and professional development statutes. And then Article 4, Section 11, beginning on line 37.26, just clarifies in statute that approved literacy intervention models have to be approved by MDE and CARI and not CARI alone. Article 4, Section 12, beginning on line 38.29, establishes a regular 5-year cycle of curricula review beginning in 2030. Article 4, Section 13, beginning on line 39.12, makes clear that literacy programs and interventions used by the Minnesota Reading Corps have to be aligned to READ Act requirements as well. And finally, Article 4, Section 14, beginning on line 39.32, is a repealer to strike the existing MDE approval process, which we know has already been completed. And then that statute did contain some expectations around regular curricula review, but we feel that the language added in Section 12 on that 5-year cycle is just more descriptive and more aligned with what our actual plans are in the future moving forward. Article 5, Section 1 was the section that I referenced was moved to Article 2 by the A1 amendment because this section has to do with statute around student expulsion and not special education. Article 5, Section 2 beginning on line 41.2 and then Section 3 beginning on line 41.16 clarifies that parental consent for initial provision of special education services before an IEP is completed and agreed to does not extend that consent for all special education services out of alignment with a student signed and agreed upon and completed IEP. The best practice we feel is always to obtain additional consent after an IEP has been formalized, but there was just some confusion about how often districts needed to formally request that consent for services between a student starting to receive some special education programs and then their specific targeted needs in their IEP. Article 5, Section 4 codifies existing federal IDEA complaint processes into Minnesota state law. This is already the process that school districts have to follow under the federal IDEA requirements around these sort of complaints. We are just looking to codify that process in state law as well. Article 6, School Nutrition, Section 1, beginning on line 45.4, this amends the subdivision governing districts who must participate in school breakfast programs and those who may be exempt. With the passage of Minnesota Free School Meals in 2023, almost all districts are automatically approved to provide no-cost breakfast and lunch if they opt into this program. So this subdivision to determine exemption standards in addition to the standards set by Free School Meals is obsolete. Article 6, Section 2, beginning on line 45.9, amends the citation back to federal regulations. Currently, this section of law cites to a very specific subparagraph of federal code. MDE guidance has always been that people who participate in these programs need to comply with the full chapter of federal law, but if we can make that clearer in law, that is what this proposal intends to do. Article 7, Section 1, beginning on line 45.19, is a citation back to federal regulations for the purpose of required parental consent when it comes to personally identifiable information about students. Last year, we had in our bill allowing DEED to access student contact information for the purposes of informing them about opportunities for transition services available to students with special needs. This just makes clear that the district does still have to obtain the parents' consent before sharing that information with DEED. Again, this was always MDE guidance based on best practice and federal requirements, but if we can make that clearer in state law, we are always happy to do so. Article 7, Section 2, beginning on line 46.14, makes it clear that MDE's Office of Inspector General investigative data is exempt from public disclosure during the course of an investigation under certain conditions. This aligns with confidentiality exemptions that the DHS OIG has. Article 7, Section 3, beginning on line 47.6, MDE OIG would be provided the law enforcement protections for the sake of this same investigative data, and this is also aligned with law enforcement protections that the DHS OIG currently has. Article 7, Section 4, beginning on line 47.13, clarifying in rulemaking statute that MDE is permitted to use expedited rulemaking for academic standards, but that is not that we are not obligated to utilize expedited as a default. Article 7, Section 5, beginning on line 47.21, shifts the responsibility to report on increasing teachers of color and American Indian teachers initiatives from PELSB to MDE. MDE's Educator Workforce Center does already oversee many of these initiatives in the required report and provides administrative support, so we feel it would be more appropriate to move that reporting to MDE. Article 7, Section 6, beginning on line 48.18, clarifies that MDE's OIG jurisdiction includes the ability to investigate theft in addition to fraud, waste, and abuse. We have learned that the crime of theft is unique from fraud and requires its own definition and its own permissions and authorities. Article 7, Section 7, beginning on line 48.29, adds clarifications to the definitions of abuse and waste in statute that we added last year, particularly clarifying that abuse includes if a program or individual is excluded from state funds and then attempts to seek other state funding after this exclusion, that falls under the category of abuse. This also adds a definition of theft that just directly cites back to the criminal Minnesota statutory definition of theft. Article 7, Section 8, beginning on line 50.18, makes clear that program participants using funds distributed by MDE who are the subject of an open investigation need to comply immediately with our OIG requests for records and documentation, both public and non-public. Article 7, Section 9, beginning on line 51.12, this reorganizes MDE's OIG statute when it comes to sanctions and appeal. This does strike some of the language currently in statute that is replaced by an upcoming section in law that adds more detail than the existing language and also puts it in a more appropriate location. Article 7, Section 10, beginning on line 53.2, makes it clear that MDE's OIG statutory investigative data protections are cited back to the correct areas of law. And this is also aligned with protections that the DHS OIG has. Article 7, Section 11, beginning on line 53.10, makes it clear that MDE's OIG investigations shall not be interfered with or obstructed by state employees. Article 7, Section 12 makes it clear that MDE's OIG immunity and confidentiality protections for good faith reporters extend until after an investigation is closed as well. Article 7, Section 13, beginning on line 54.3, this makes clear that MDE may recommend another agency prohibit or remove program participants excluded from public funds that MDE administers, and we can make that recommendation that they be excluded from receiving public funds by a Minnesota or federal agency if that person or program has been excluded from MDE funds. Article 7, Section 14, this elaborates on that stricken section in Section 9. So Section 14 requires that MDE, within 5 days of action taken against a program participant, has to send a notice of the action and information on their appeal rights to the participant who has had the action taken against them. Section 15, beginning on line 55.12, goes into more detail about the rights of the recipient of this notice of action and their rights to appeal. If there is no appeal filed within 30 days of the notice being mailed to the recipient, the actions taken by MDE after those 30 days will be considered final and binding. Article 7, Section 16, beginning on line 55.26, this proposal allows MDE to suspend payments to providers when there's a credible allegation of fraud for which an investigation is pending, and that can be for programs administered by Minnesota state agencies or a federal agency. Article 7, Section 17, beginning on line 56.27, adds an excess tax increment submission date to statute. This mirrors the abatement language within that same statute in Subdivision 2. This proposed change adds a submission due date of February 1st to the excess tax increment statute. MDE internally does already use this February 1st submission date and is working on automating this process to make it easier, and setting this date in statute would align with our plans to automate these processes across submissions. Finally, Article 7, Section 18, beginning on line 58.14, gives the MDE OIG permission to access non-public data without the consent of the subject of the investigation for the purposes of investigating fraud, theft, waste, and abuse. And, Mr. Chair, that concludes the walkthrough. We stand ready for questions.
Wonderful. Thank you, Ms. Arriola. With that, we'll move on to public testimony. I have three folks who have signed up. We'll begin with Ms. Rachel Berger, and on deck will be Mr. John Olson. Okay. You want to come on down? We'll have you ready to go. Wonderful. Welcome, Mrs. Berger. And as you get set up, I want to welcome you to the committee. And when you begin, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Rachel Berger, representing the Dyslexia and Literacy Coalition today. The coalition is made up of local organizations, including the Reading Center, Learning Disabilities Association of America, the International Dyslexia Association, Decoding Dyslexia Minnesota, Groves Learning Organization, Hill Murray, and Orton-Gillingham Specialists. It's committed to serving dyslexia and grade-level literacy proficiency through education, training, student support, and advocacy. The Dyslexia Literacy Coalition has concerns on changing any language in House File 1306 under the READ Act, Subdivision 2, Identification. Our former approach to literacy instruction, known as balanced literacy, educators were not trained to collect data on foundational reading skills to support instruction in the areas of phonemic awareness, decoding, and fluency. That data is critical to support educators in this shift in instructional practice from balanced literacy to science of reading. We are collecting that data now. Current statute requires school districts to screen for characteristics of dyslexia and report in their local literacy plans, which includes screening results to the commissioner by June 15th. The newly hired literacy data specialist, Dr. Susan Dowds, will then have the opportunity to compile the data we've been collecting since the screening for characteristics of dyslexia was passed into law. From there, late fall of 2025, the data reports are going to be submitted to legislative committees. We believe that the proposed changes under Subdivision 2 are premature and that any adjustments to the current language are unnecessary until data can be used to inform those changes.
Wonderful. Thank you, Ms. Berger. And with that, we'll move on to Ms. Sturls.
Thank you.
On deck, we have Matt Schaefer.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you. And if you could just state your name for the record.
Don Olson. I am representing the Minnesota Science Teachers Association. I recently retired from the Minnesota Department of Education, where I was a science specialist for 12 years. And I previously worked as a teacher and district science lead for St. Paul Public Schools. The Minnesota Science Teachers Association opposes the proposed bill lines 313 to 318. These additions to the credit equivalent statute 120B.024 subdivision 2 would allow a health science class to be considered a science credit, giving students and schools the false impression that they are fulfilling the science graduation requirements through a health course. The graduation requirements in statute 120B.024 subdivision 1 specify that students must meet the following requirements: 3 credits of science, including 1 credit to satisfy all the earth and space standards for grades 9 through 12, 1 credit to satisfy all the life science standards for grades 9 through 12, and 1 credit to satisfy all the chemistry or physics standards for grades 9 through 12. It is important to note that these requirements include 3 credits and also the satisfying the associated standards. These standards are based on science education research about concepts and skills all students need to be college and career ready and accomplished citizens. The committee that wrote these standards included colleges, K-12, educators, and industry representatives. It should also be noted that the graduation requirements also include some requirements about health, credit sufficient to satisfy the state standards in health upon adoption of statewide rules for implementing health standards. Hence, there is no need to consider a health course as a science credit. Any additional health science courses would need to be considered electives and not science credits. They would not meet all the science standards in one of the 3 areas specified in the science graduation requirements. There is no benefit to calling them science credits. Students may falsely assume that they fulfill the science graduation requirements through health courses. This situation is like other courses that schools offer as electives that do not fulfill science graduation requirements, such as natural resource conservation, agriculture, anatomy, physiology, and crime scene investigation. We want all our students to be exposed to quality science learning, which includes developing science knowledge and skills such as conducting investigations, analyzing data, scientific problem solving, and making claims of evidence. This requires teachers to have a strong content knowledge, effective science pedagogy, and understanding of students' developmental process. Specialized health education courses in high schools are often taught by community experts who lack some of these qualifications. We urge the committee to consider the needs of all of our students and provide them with a well-rounded science education to prepare them for the futures and the needs of our state. Thank you, committee.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. And up next we have Mr. Matt Shaver. If you would, after you get settled in, please state your name for the record and proceed. Thank you.
Chair Hill, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Matt Shaver, and I'm the Senior Policy Director at Allies. We're advocates for students. Thank you for the opportunity to share my organization's feedback on the MDE policy bill. Thank you, Chair Jordan, for carrying the language. We support efforts to increase access to rigorous coursework like PSEO, so appreciate the technical corrections in Article 1 to ensure it's clear that students who attend charter schools and tribal schools can take PSEO and dual enrollment courses. In Article 2, the section on Comprehensive Achievement and Civic Readiness, NEE, World's Best Workforce Report, proposes to replace one of the goals of our accountability system, which is currently, quote, school readiness, with, quote, striving to support successful learners through inclusive, quality, developmentally appropriate early learning experiences. I just want to push the department to see if they can make that new goal along.
That's a joke. It's a good goal.
It's a joke. Okay. A little error. Okay. All right. Article 3 has several common sense accountability reforms on the charter sector that will improve transparency. For example, requiring board meetings to be recorded and posted online just like other public schools do. It's a great addition to the work that we want to make sure that we have for our schools in the state. Article 4 deals with the revisions to the READ Act. We have proudly worked alongside many stakeholders in good faith to develop the READ Act over the last few years. We just want to take this opportunity to urge the department to listen to the feedback they've heard from advocates in the dyslexia community specifically about the downside of overcorrecting on established practices to support students with reading difficulties. Finally, it is disappointing not to see any policy proposals from the Department of Education to provide a better response to chronic absenteeism in Minnesota. There's nothing here about timely statewide data reporting, no ideas around clear and consistent attendance definitions, no policies to break down silos between districts, counties, and the state so students aren't falling through the cracks. MDE has been at the table for every committee hearing on attendance going back to last year. Before that, they participated in an attendance study group in the interim and have participated in ongoing policy conversations, and that's all valuable and appreciated. I am certain, we are certain, that Commissioner Jett and his team knows how corrosive Minnesota's chronic absenteeism crisis is to everything we want students, schools to be for kids. But when it comes to what we should do legislatively to address this issue, what we have seen so far from the department has often been feedback on why new policy ideas may be unworkable or too expensive or unnecessary, rather than leveraging their position to see the whole of the education ecosystem as an asset to the bipartisan, multi-sector work of imagining a more cohesive, coherent, and effective statewide response to our attendance crisis. House File 1308 is 60 pages of new ideas and changes to the way our education system should work. How is it possible after all this time there's nothing here to address 200,000 chronically absent students? From top to bottom, the department is filled with smart, caring, thoughtful people. Come build something better with us, please. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and thank you all for your public service to our city.
Thank you, Mr. Shaver. And with that, we have no more testifiers, so we'll move on now to member discussion. Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Jordan, and agency staff. I think it should be no surprise the area of concern that I have is not what's in the bill, it's what's not in the bill. We have had in-depth conversations about attendance. We have come with many ideas, and you know, I think we were really hoping that this would be a collective opportunity to kind of see what ideas you all really had. I know that we are in constant communication about it. I do really feel like you're coming with genuine support with us. It's just a little bit disappointing that we didn't see anything in here. Trusting and hoping that we'll continue to work together. We have a lot of work to do. Maybe the answer is you're just leaning into our bill, right? But I just wanted to get that on the record. I know Matt Shaver said that as well, but I do just really think we do a lot around the reading component. We just need to also do a lot around the attendance and truancy component. No statement needed. I trust that we'll continue to do the work unless you feel like you need to respond.
Chair Jordan, any follow-up?
No, Mr. Chair. I would say that, you know, as a committee, I'm happy to lean into the work that Representative Keeler and Representative Lawrence and Representative Bakeberg and others are doing on it. So I don't know if the department wants to talk, but as a chair of this committee, I think both Chair Bennett and I have leaned into that work. So thank you for having, for to all the members on the committee that have that work that we can lean into.
No response, Mr. Chair. Oh. Representative Keeler, no, she can text me anytime.
Thank you. Other members? Representative Lawrence.
Yeah, Chair Hill, thank you very much. Representative Jordan, a question I have for MDE is if you could just comment. We had a science department or science representative come and comment about the repercussions of what's being presented in letters H and I under, section, you know what section.
Yeah.
But if you could comment on the reasoning for this and the repercussions that it has on science, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Lawrence. I do appreciate the opportunity to comment. I want to just thank the Science Teachers Association for the feedback. Definitely was part of the value we get out of public hearings. We absolutely want to hear folks' concerns that just may not have been in our frame of reference. The intent behind this bill was to try to be proactive to set our districts up for success to implement the statewide health standards, knowing that there's going to be a little bit of confusion as folks transition away from local health standards only to statewide education standards that may cover areas that they just do not have existing staff who have that expertise, or they'd like to leverage some of their staff that already do work in the field to be able to allow them to provide some health education and allow students to get credit for some of these things. We absolutely are open to the feedback that the Science Teachers Associations have provided, and we are happy to continue the conversation. We really wanted this to be a way for us to be proactive and forward-looking in successful implementation of those standards in the coming years.
Representative Lawrence, any follow-up?
Yes, Mr. Chair Hill. kind of follow back. You referenced the health standards, and as I read this, H and I, one, it refers to an educator's standards of requirement, and I refers to the credit that a student can receive. It has nothing to do with health standards. And so, once again, I'll just reiterate the same question. What is the repercussion on the education for a student? You know, how does that affect the requirements in that they're required to get for credit-wise, and how does this fit in?
Ms. Arriola.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lawrence, so this is in a statute amending career and technical education specifically. So this, when this is referencing health education teachers, this is a narrow focus to the career and technical education offerings. And the reference back is a similar carve out that we do provide to CTE courses in things like agriculture, mm-hmm. That the teachers who may not come from a traditional teaching background to meet all the rules under Minnesota rule, we know that CTE teachers can have a variety of experience. And so this was our attempt to look at an area where we can leverage folks who may already be providing similar instruction to, again, just make the transition a little smoother down the line. But definitely appreciate the feedback.
Okay. Any further questions, Mr.
Chair Hill? Last comment. So my understanding is, and I get the teacher part because I understand the egg side of things. So a student could exchange one of their credits for this health credit in science. Is that what this does here? That's the way I read it. I just want to verify that's what this does here. If I'm a student and I want to take a health science course, that could be in exchange for one of my other credit sciences, correct? That's what was testified, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Ms. Arriola.
Yes, and.
Okay.
Representative. This section does not remove any of the existing standards for local or state standards. The second two lines of subdivision I are in attempt to address that when we're talking about using this credit, it's not an automatic. You have to demonstrate that these standards, whether they're state or local, depending on the year, that they've also been met. So there's that demonstration requirement there as well.
Okay. Thank you. No further questions.
Thank you, Representative. Next up, we have Representative Green.
Thank you, Chair. Chair Hill and agency and Representative Jordan. And thank you for your question, Representative Lawrence. I have very similar questions, so I'm glad that you started the conversation there. I'm concerned about this change. I think when we hear from our science teachers that are in the classroom with students and they tell us that this is going to be confusing and this is going to have a negative impact on potentially all the standards that we do in science, that we need to listen to them. We have the lowest computer science. We are the lowest in the entire country, and STEM career paths grow faster than other occupations right now at like a 10% rate. And so to touch any of those standards, to shift them around at all, I think is dangerous territory for our students, to be honest. And so the suggestion that a health science career technical education credit, it really should be an elective. It's not, it should not replace the standards. And I get that there's different pressure points in terms of how we deliver that, but I think it's confusing for a student, because I understood it, what Representative Lawrence said, like, if you read that as a student, I would think that I could take this class and it would automatically kind of cover one of my standards and one of the credits. And so I would really encourage you to look at that and listen to our teachers here. And the same thing with, the requirements to teach science and have that replacement. So I don't know if you guys want to anyone wants to respond, but those are my thoughts.
Chair Hill, Representative Green, I don't have any further response except just that we appreciate the feedback. Obviously we need to take this back and determine, you know, if there's areas that we can offer to address these issues or if we just need further conversation. So I don't want a non-response to feel like we're not taking the issue seriously, but I definitely don't want to speak out of turn before discussing with our experts. So I appreciate the science teacher's testimony, and we'll be discussing that further.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions?
No.
Okay. Any other member discussion? Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Hill. And I really want to emphasize the concerns that were brought up by the Literacy Coalition. And when I was reading through the bill, and of course now I have to get to my spot because I was looking at the places that we were at earlier in the READ Act, to remove how we're looking in at literacy, to simply look at, I was listening to your presentation and you were talking about how oral language is the best practices for these things now, here it is, that we're looking at oral language. How we learn how to speak is very different than how we learn how to read. Speaking is innate. We learn that through immersion. We don't do that with reading. And so to take out these pillars of literacy on how we're screening and all these different things is very concerning. I really echo the concerns that we're talking about with the Literacy Coalition. And I know some of that was fixed in the Senate file and the other body. Sorry, we're not supposed to talk about the other body. In the amendment, I get that. But, you know, there to remove some of the language, where am I at here? Why are you not? I'm not finding it on where I'm looking at right now. But to remove some of that language is really concerning. And to just have a reading fluency screener or to just look at reading difficulties. I mean, there's a reason why Representative Clardy and I are looking very closely on how we can make sure our teachers are trained in identifying dyslexia. I mean, this is and to the point that Ms. Berger was trying to make, READ Act has only been in effect for a year or so. We need data. Why are we messing around with how we're collecting data without looking at the data first? That doesn't make any sense. So I want to echo those concerns. When I first read this, and of course, as I said, I'm not finding what I'm looking for right at this moment. But when I was looking at some of the things that were being removed and replaced with, I was concerned. And here it is.
Page 30.
And so I just want to make sure that we are being very careful and cautious with lots of collaboration. They are listening to the people who have experts, who are expertise in this, and that we are judicious. Chair Jordan was exactly right. We're going to be talking about the READ Act for the rest of our legislative careers. Like, this is an act that we're going to continue to look at over and over and over again, especially as it expands to secondary education, as we look at how we look at disciplinary literacy and how we teach about literacy in secondary schools. We're going to be talking about this for years. At the same time, what you've started to collect based on the science of reading, evidence-based reading, don't go back. Don't go back. And so let's get the data first before we start changing how we're doing this. So I would seriously echo those concerns that we have heard from our literary coalition and the experts in the field. So there isn't a question in there, but I would like to say that this is something that we really should be taking a closer look at. I know this bill is being laid over and that's the governor's proposal, and that we are going to be the decision makers as we start looking at this. And so we'll be able to add things about chronic absenteeism that was chronically left out, or, you know, things with literacy. So it's something that we really should be talking about as a committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair Mueller. Next up on our list, we have Chair Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a specific question before I give some closing comments, if I may, to Ms. Adiola. In line 5310, starting there, I'll let you get to that spot. Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious, this strikes language on the retaliation for an employer individual who discloses information on fraud, waste, abuse, and so on. And down below in 5318, it gives immunity from civil liability and then confidentiality to that person. But it strikes out, and, you know, starting in line 5310, the retaliation parts, which references to the current section of law 181.932. And that current section deals with so much more than civil penalties. An employer shall not discharge, discipline, penalize, interfere with, threaten, restrain, coerce, and so on. I won't go into all those parts. So am I missing something? Did it get put in down below, the retaliation part, or is that simply being removed, the retaliation component?
Ms. Ariel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Bennett. I'm very happy to talk about that section. So the disclosure of information by employees, which is the chapter of law under 181 that this stricken language does refer back to, our staff's read of this was that the requirements around public employment differ so greatly, and just the nature of public employment differs so greatly from some of the requirements and prohibitions laid out in this law, that our approach is in the following section to kind of make it clear when we talk about reporting, we talk about good faith reporting, we talk about immunity, and that when we're talking about, for this purpose, it is the whistleblowers, the good faith report, however that's referred to. Our staff just felt that this new language under subdivision 8 was more reflective of the realities that the work of the OIG is likely to encounter. Very happy to discuss more if there are areas of 181 that we feel do apply to state employees, but I know that that was kind of the impetus, is that 181 is really meant to protect folks working under private industry, and that the duties and just everyday actions of public employees do differ.
Chair Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. I would encourage you to look at that, because I do believe how it was previously stated covered a lot more, which public employees may endure as well as whistleblowers, whether it's, bullying, threatening, any of those things that are referenced there. It's much more than just civil liability or confidentiality, but we could talk offline about that more and some other areas as well. And so thank you for bringing this forward, and there are provisions in this bill that I believe need closer examination. I look forward to working with Chair Jordan and MDE and provisions that we as a team would like to see addressed and included. But good to hear these things. I'm happy that we're all working together as a team to make education better for our kids. So thank you, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Bennett. And now we'll move to closing remarks. Chair Jordan, please.
Thank you, Chair Hill. Thank you, Chair Bennett. Thank you, Vice Chair Mueller. And thank you to all the members on the committee for your thoughtful comments. I know there's a lot in this bill. There's several articles that encompass everything we do in education, whether it's, you know, just what kinds of things, how are we learning about bodies and science, to what is the very detailed process that we investigate waste, fraud, and abuse. So there's a lot in here. There's a lot that we will continue to work on in a bipartisan manner. I want to especially, in thinking through how much is in this bill, I think shows to how much that MDE really does do. MDE is working on a lot of things. And so thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Ms. Arriola. And thank you to everyone who works at MDE for supporting every student, every teacher, and every family here in Minnesota. So there's a lot in this bill. I look forward to working with all of you to bring provisions forward and refine what needs to be refined. So thank you, Madam Chair. And with that, I renew my motion to weigh over House File 1306 as amended for further consideration.
With that, that'll be the motion. And this meeting is now adjourned.
Thank you.